the headlines, the European Union's Brexit negotiator says a trade deal with the UK still hangs in the balance. The UK becomes the first country in the world to authorize Pfizer-BioNTech's coronavirus vaccine for widespread use. And firefighters in Australia are battling to contain a massive bushfire that has been burning a popular tourist spot off the northeast coast for 6 weeks now. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital town. This is World News, our top story for this half hour. The European Union's Brexit negotiator says a trade deal with the UK still hangs in the balance. Michel Barnier has said differences remain on three main issues. He made the comments at a closed-door briefing to EU national envoys. The bloc's member states have expressed concern over the fate of a post-Brexit trade deal with Britain. They reportedly fear that the EU could clinch a deal at any cost. Britain formally left the bloc in January but remains bound by its rules until the transition period ends on December the 31st. The two sides are discussing their future relations but are at loggerheads over a number of issues. Britain has become the first country to approve the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine for use. The UK government says a vaccine will be made available across the country from next week, Pfizer said. Britain's approval of the vaccine marks a historic moment in the fight against the pandemic. The company said it anticipates more approvals. Therefore, it's now focusing on safely supplying a high-quality vaccine around the world. The UK is the worst-hit European country by the pandemic. It has registered over 1.6 million infections and more than 59,000 deaths.
Despite working at breakneck speed, the makers of the COVID-19 vaccines now on the verge of being rolled out insist no corners have been cut. Biotech company Moderna has applied for US and European emergency authorization for its vaccine, which it claims to be 94.1% effective with no serious safety concerns. Meanwhile, United Airlines are getting ready to kickstart a global supply and distribution network for Pfizer's vaccine. Governments everywhere are trying to secure their share to kickstart their economies.
We have every reason now to be very hopeful that these vaccines really will turn the tide in the struggle against the disease and unlock not just this country, but unlock the whole of the world and give people finally a sense of relief.
And as we set out this weekend, we've secured 2 million further doses, meaning that we in the UK now have access to a total of 357 million doses of seven different vaccines.
A mass inoculation program is expected to begin in late December, and more than 80% need to be vaccinated for the global initiative to succeed.
The challenges of mass distribution are immense. Some of those challenges are convincing people that the vaccine is necessary and safe, because this has happened before and things have gone wrong.
In 2009, a British company developed a swine flu vaccine. It was approved by the European Medicines Agency for use across the EU, but following a widespread vaccination campaign, 1,800 people, primarily children and young adults under 30, developed debilitating narcolepsy that causes excessive and often uncontrollable drowsiness. So is this happening too fast?
Apparently the MHRA, the Medicines and Health Regulatory Authority in this country, has put out a tender which was put out through the EU. I think that's how it got picked up into the news. But this tender is for an artificial intelligence system, which they are saying is necessary to spend public money on that because there are going to be a very high level of adverse events. Now, we obviously have had vaccination in this country for a very long time, mass vaccination programs on a routine basis. So that's quite surprising because we've got all of these other vaccines with a system which copes with their adverse events. But apparently now we need an entire new standalone system because the level of adverse events expected are going to be kind of off the scale of what our existing systems can handle.
Children will not be immunised, but the British government has not ruled out making the vaccines compulsory for adults. Westminster is mulling ways to incentivise getting the jab first. People may need an immunity passport or QR code on their phone to attend football matches, the theatre and other events like the Tokyo Olympics. Qantas Airlines have already announced that proof that you've been vaccinated will be compulsory on its flights. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Russia has reported its highest daily death toll from coronavirus with nearly 590 fatalities in the last 24 hours. Figure pandemic death toll to more than 41,000. The country on Wednesday, 25,000 new infections. That brings 1.3 million. In Germany, the Robert Koch Institute reports 1,300 infections and over 480 deaths. Elsewhere in Europe, total COVID cases in Poland are nearing 1 million. The continent is facing a second wave of the disease. A number of countries have been posting record numbers of daily deaths and cases in the past month. The United States has recorded more than 2,500 coronavirus deaths in 24 hours. That's the highest daily toll since late April. The figure was reported by Johns Hopkins University on Tuesday. It registered over 180,000 new infections. The same day, according to the university, the number of hospitalizations hit 99,000. That's a record as well. The situation is dire in several Midwestern states, including Indiana and South Dakota. Experts fear a new surge in infections several days after the Thanksgiving holiday that saw millions of Americans travel. Total COVID cases in the U.S. are above 13.7 million. Deaths have exceeded 270,000. Both are the highest in the world. Wyatt Reed in Washington, D.C. says the coronavirus crisis in the U.S. is largely due to a lack of proper state response to the pandemic.
Trend of inability and unwillingness to treat the pandemic from the top to the bottom, from the federal government to the state government to the local level. And of course, this larger trend of refusing to go along with the Thanksgiving guidelines in many cases, that's contributing to it. But of course, we have to understand that from the get-go, there has been no real state response, no real accountability or responsibility on that end, and it's all been on the individual.
The U.S. Justice Department says there is no proof of widespread fraud in the November 3rd presidential vote, further dimming Donald Trump's hopes of re-election. Attorney General William Barr said the department has not found fraud on a scale substantial enough to revoke Joe Biden's projected victory in the race. This is while Trump's personal lawyer Rudy Giuliani slammed Barr's remarks, accusing the Justice Department of failing to conduct proper probes. Giuliani vowed that the president's team will continue its legal fight. On Monday, Arizona and Wisconsin certified Biden's win, becoming the last of the six battleground states to do so. Trump insists that he won the race for the White House, but is being cheated out of victory. Colin Campbell says U.S. President Donald Trump's claims of widespread fraud in November 3rd election are only taken seriously by his diehard supporters.
This is something that he's asserted after weeks of pretty much reporters and other officials saying that this is the conclusion that would inevitably happen, that the president really had no justification or evidence of there being rampant voter fraud across the country, that there are dead people voting, that there were illegal registrations, that the whole system is corrupt. All of this was said by the president to really electrify his base, that there was some wrongdoing and maybe to create some unrest that could help him stay in his position as president. But as we have observed, none of these processes or operations have been working for the president. He's really every day said that he's won the election, that the election is fraudulent, but there's been no evidence that's supporting any of this, and no one seems to be taking him seriously, except for maybe his diehard supporters. Other than that, most politicians are starting to accept that there's a transition happening. There are some Republicans who have been very quiet, but it's being reported that really they know deep down that the president lost the election, and they're just keeping quiet so as not to receive any wrath from the commander-in-chief. As we know, the president can be vindictive and vengeful. And I think that there are a lot of Republicans who are not showing or not exhibiting any bravery.
Massive bushfires burning on Australia's Fraser Island for 6 weeks now are threatening tourist areas there. The wildfires have so far raised half of the island off the northeast coast, forcing tourists to flee. Firefighters keep battling the bushfires. They've dropped more than 1 million liters of water and fire retardant gel in the past couple of days alone. Officials say conditions remain unpredictable and can change rapidly. Total fire bans have been enforced in several parts of the northeast that comes as the first major heat wave of Australia's bushfire season hits. Fraser Island is a World Heritage listed for its tropical rainforests and sand dunes. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has predicted that an economic war waged by the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump is nearing its end. Rouhani said Trump's so-called maximum pressure campaign against the Iranian nation has failed. He said the U.S. sought to paralyze Iran's economy and make life unbearable for the nation, but to no avail. President Rouhani said the Iranian people managed to overcome U.S. sanctions. The Trump administration has imposed unprecedented sanctions against Iran since it withdrew from the nuclear deal in 2018. Now the projected winner of the U.S. 2020 presidential election, Joe Biden, has promised to rejoin the deal. Iranian legislators have overwhelmingly ratified the outlines of a bill that authorizes the resumption of nuclear activities restricted under the 2015 nuclear deal, as Yusuf Jalali reports.
Iran's incumbent parliament has taken by far the most headline-making measure since the beginning of its tenure. 251 out of 260 lawmakers voted yes to a draft bill dubbed the Strategic Action Plan to lift sanctions. The bill comprises 9 articles, all authorizing the resumption of nuclear activities that have been limited under the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. The first and most important article requires the government to disregard the 3.67% cap that the deal has imposed on the grade of enriched uranium and resume enrichment at 20% purity level. The parliament's bill now needs the approval of the Guardian Council to become law.
My colleagues and I in Parliament have tasked the government to suspend any foreign access and monitoring beyond the additional protocol within 2 months of the adoption of the law. The Islamic Republic will then continue to cooperate within the framework of the IAEA safeguard, but not the additional protocol. The government will also have to return to the 20% uranium enrichment grade needed to produce medicine for cancer patients. It will produce at least 120 kilograms of uranium with 20% enrichment annually at Fordo and store it inside the country. There are other steps all taken to revive our rights and respond to Europe's lack of commitment.
The new legislation was proposed in the wake of the assassination of top Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, which Iran blames on Israel. Tel Aviv has long been openly trying to torpedo Iran's nuclear energy program. The Israeli regime was also implicated in the targeted killings of 4 other Iranian nuclear scientists nearly a decade ago.
The footprints of Israel cannot be clear in this case. Mr. Fakhrizadeh has been the number one target of Mossad for 2 decades. And recently there are reports that the weapon collected from the site of Tiris Act bears the logo and the specification of Israel military industry, and Israel has not commented on the issue yet, but it should brace for serious if for that from Iran.
Iran's change of tone toward the nuclear deal came in 2018, following the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the multilateral accord. Iran has also been criticizing the European parties to the deal for failing to live up to their commitments under the deal. Last year, Tehran began a stepwise suspension of its nuclear obligations to make the EU keep its side of the bargain.
This last move by Parliament is the boldest countermeasure Iran has taken to, quote, keep the balance between its obligations and rights under the accord. They say this way they will unlock the shackles placed on the country's nuclear program and pursue the goals of assassinated nuclear scientists like Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Media reports say a leading Israeli lawmaker has presented a new plan to Parliament to further expand settlement activities in the West Bank and the Jordan Valley. The plan also includes measures to establish a number of industrial zones and expand tourism on the Palestinian lands. Mona Candela has more in this report.
As part of Israel's land grabbing and illegal settlement expanding policies in the occupied West Bank, Israeli media have reported that a Knesset committee member and senior Likud member Nir Barkat has presented a plan to the Knesset to further expand settlement activities in the occupied West Bank and the Jordan Valley. According to the plan, Israel needs to establish some industrial zones and expand tourism in the areas.
Nir Barkat is one of the establishment. This fanatic Zionist establishment, that they are behind this colonial project. So what he did is not, he's saying, and what he offered is not something new. It's part of the whole Zionist plan, colonial plan, that's already going on the ground. When we talk this year about 15,000 housing units that has been issued, this is double than the last year.
Barkat has also announced that Israel aims to settle 2 million Jewish settlers in the occupied West Bank. This comes after contacts took place between settlers and Barkat himself over the past few days. Experts say to make this available, Barkat has put a plan to tighten Israel's grip on the Palestinian lands, adding that the Israeli regime will have to approve these plans before the inauguration of the next U.S. administration on 20 January 21 to make sure they will be applied.
Israeli parties are using the remaining period of Trump administration to carry out an ethnic cleansing project, first in Jerusalem al-Quds and then in the occupied West Bank. Tel Aviv wants to restrict Palestinians in their villages and at the same time to control their surrounding areas without official declaration of annexation.
During the four-year period of U.S. President Donald Trump, settlement activity has more than doubled, as the number of plans approved by Netanyahu's regime increased 2.5 times compared to the previous 4 years.
For years, Israeli authorities have continued to facilitate the expansion of illegal settlements in Palestinian territories. Tel Aviv has done everything possible to minimize the Palestinian population. Experts say what Israel is doing is annexation of Palestinian lands without official declaration. Mona Kandil in front of the Israeli settlement of Beit Il, occupied Ramallah.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Amir Kabir. Khayyam. Maulana. Avicenna. Khwarizmi. Iranian notables, sources of global honor.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, in this episode, you will get more familiar with the Iranian poet who lived in 7th and 8th centuries AH, corresponding to 13th and 14th centuries AD. He was Seyf Faraghani. Seyf Faraghani has been known as a leader of socio-political poetry in Farsi language. The 7th and 8th centuries AH were among the bright eras of Iran's literary history, as masters of poetry and Gnosticism like Maulana, Sa'di, and Hafez lived in that era. We have said that little is known about his life and times. Stay tuned for more. You have also heard that Saifuddin Abu Muhammad Muhammad Faraghani was born in Transoxiana and left his town Farghane for Asia Minor, current Turkey, in youth. He lived the rest of his life in Aksaray, a small town of the region. Dear listeners, you also heard that the Iranian society was so much chaotic due to the Mongol invasion that most of the literary figures and poets lived in fear and tried to survive. What one finds in the works of that era mirrors the pains and misery of people under the Mongol rule. The sufferings of masses were reflected as complaints in the works and poems and writers or in the form of comedy and farce of poets such as Sa'di Shirazi and Obaid Zakani. There were three groups in the turbulent conditions of that era. The first group was the laymen who didn't understand the causes of the existing conditions and just tolerated them. The second group consisted of politicians who had assimilated themselves with the rulers to preserve their worldly gains. But the third group comprised of responsible writers and men of letters who would either try to advise their ruling class or castigated them through satires and sarcasm. The works remaining from poets and writers are indeed a mirror of the ups and downs of the land that they lived in. Researchers, through examining these works, can find out the way of living, thoughts, customs, religion, and socio-political developments of every people. The literature of protest, as one of the literary genres, has been able to depict the anomalies in the society and also corruption of the ruling system in every era. Saif Faraghani can be called one of the leaders of this genre, as protest forms the core of most of his poems. A significant part of poems in Farsi literature used to be dedicated to panegyrics for kings and the royal family or the ministers and even local rulers. These poems were devoid of reality and were mainly flattery. Such poems have never been approved by wise men and even the poets. Most of these eulogies would be done for the sake of financial gains, while a small number of poets were forced to eulogize a king or ruler in order to be immune from the threats on their lives. On the opposite side of the spectrum were the protesters. They were the poets and writers who protested to the status quo and did their best to show their discontent with the government. For sure, such literary men were constantly in danger. However, they would never keep silent in the face of the economic, social, and political corruption. Their works would, in fact, portray the miseries of people. Thus, the laymen would welcome their works, though these literary figures were often homeless, wandering from one place to another. The literature of protest has always been there in the Farsi literature. This genre is like a flag hoisted against social injustice and misrule of kings and governors. The poets who were puppets of rulers and kings were often tacit vis-à-vis the oppression against masses, but the ones who lived among people felt it as their mission to stand up against injustice and corruption. Therefore, they would make use of various literary methods to be the voice of the oppressed and the weak. They would employ farce, irony, satire, sarcasm, comedy, exaggeration, metaphor, and so on to convey their meaning and explain the economic woes of lower classes. At times, they would also use advice and admonishment to convey their meaning. Although many poets and thinkers believe that advice is not effective, in awakening kings and disclosing their injustice and corruption. Unfortunately, most of the invading ethnicities would not tolerate the cultural brilliance and supremacy of the Iranian nation. Therefore, instead of trying to cope with the lofty culture and customs of civilized people in the Iranian plateau, they tried to violate their culture and devastate their cultural achievements and honors. There were many poets in various social classes, but it was the Sufi and mystic poets and writers who tried to expose social problems of their era. They would clearly criticize the ruling system's deficiencies and flaws. Saif Farahani was one of such poets. Dear listeners, next time we will continue this discussion.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. In Iran, lawmakers have given the green light to a plan to address the legal sanctions imposed on the country. Iranian parliamentarians want the Rouhani administration to produce 120 kilos of uranium at 20% purity level and also make use of advanced centrifuges, among other things. Well, some analysts regard this as the first reaction to the Friday assassination of an outstanding Iranian nuclear scientist. The Iranian parliament speaker has stressed the move signals the end of the one-sided game as regards the Iran nuclear deal, or the JCPOA.
Iran's parliament or majlis has endorsed a bill titled Strategic Action to Remove Sanctions and Protect the Rights of the Iranian Nation. The legislation, which still requires the endorsement of Iran's Guardian Council, is aimed at tackling U.S.-imposed sanctions against the country. The bill obliges the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran to produce uranium enriched at 20% purity for peaceful purposes and store inside the country at least 120 kilograms of the product annually. The bill also mandates the installation and operation of advanced IR-2M and IR-6 centrifuges. Furthermore, it calls for a metallic uranium production plant to be put into operation in the central city of Isfahan. The Iranian lawmakers have also demanded the optimization and relaunching of Arak's heavy water reactor and the designing of another such facility. The bill also stipulates that Iran will withdraw from the additional protocol to the non-proliferation treaty if the remaining parties to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal do not fully comply with their obligations and restrictions against Iran's trade continue to remain in place. The bill comes after repeated complaints by Iran that is not reaping the fruits of the nuclear agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, while it's remained committed to the agreement.
Truth of the matter again is that the gap and the key gap and the key point of concern was a serious lack of commitment by the West, either in the United States or the European Union, that resulted in new courses of action taken by Iran.
Under the deal, Iran imposed restrictions on its nuclear program in return for sanctions relief. However, U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the deal in 2018 and imposed the toughest ever sanctions under its so-called maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. Despite the U.S. move, Tehran remained fully compliant with the JCPOA for an entire year. But amid the failure of the remaining signatories to deliver the benefits of the deal to Iran, the country began a gradual suspension of its commitments. The timing of the approval of the bill is also noteworthy as it comes just days after the assassination of prominent Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh near Tehran. In fact, an informed source has told Press TV that the bill is indeed Iran's first practical response to the assassination. Fakhrizadeh's killing is the latest in a long line of assassination of Iran's nuclear scientists blamed on Israel. Iran has vowed revenge, and judging by the swiftness and decisiveness of the parliament bill, the culprits and masterminds of the killing should be on tenterhooks.
Now, without much further ado, let's get to the point and start the show. Joining me will be peace and justice activists and analysts Sarbaz Ruhollah Rezvi from the Iranian city of Qom, and writer and political commentator Shabir Hassan Ali, who's joining us out of Leicester. Good to have both of you, gentlemen. Welcome. Let's go to Iranian city of Qom. The Iranian parliament argues, Sarbaz, that enough is enough and that the one-sided compliance with a nuclear deal should come to an end. Let's have your comment on that.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Sure.
I think what the Iranian parliament did was actually, as it was mentioned, the first solid step as a reaction to the assassination that took place on Friday, in which prominent Iranian nuclear scientist Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was, you know, martyred. A couple of hours after the assassination, there was a statement on behalf of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Imam Khamenei, where it was mentioned, 2 points were highlighted in that statement. The first point was that there should be a retaliation, there should be a revenge to anyone who has done this evil act. Second was the path and the move and the, you know, the process that Dr. Fakhrizadeh was following should be followed. It should not be stopped and it should be pursued again. And the decision that took place today, the decision of the Iranian parliament, was actually a response to that, because the decision of the Iranian parliament today is actually paving the path for development of the Iranian nuclear technology for its peaceful goals. And it is actually because there were restrictions after JCPOA, when Iranians admitted to sign JCPOA, naturally speaking, there were sort of restrictions on the development of the Iranian nuclear facilities, Iranian nuclear science, and those who were the system that was working on the nuclear technology and development of Iran. So now, by this act of the Iranian parliament, the problems, the obstacles in front of this progress is actually removed. So this means that the process and the goal that the prominent Iranian scientist Fakhrizadeh was looking after, was working for, that is now in a better condition. Those who are working in this field of technology will now actually find a better environment in front of them to follow their researchers. And this is the biggest response on behalf of the Iranians to the Zionist regime. It was mentioned that, analytically speaking, all evidences are showing that behind this act of assassination is the Zionist regime. So the decision of the Iranian parliament, which was on its proper time, actually showed that Iran has the will for continuation of the path that someone like Dr. Fakhrizadeh was following.
Okay.
And I hope that this is actually a game-changing decision by the Iranian parliament.
Right. Now, turning to Leicester, Shabir, Iranian legislators want the sanctions lifted as soon as possible. Is this too much they're asking for, more than 2.5 years after the U.S. pullout from the deal and the reimposition of sanctions?
I think, first of all, I'd like to extend condolences to the Supreme Leader and to yourself and to all of the Iranians on the martyrdom of Dr. Fakhrizadeh. In terms of the sanctions, I think really Iran needs to get a grip now. This idea of sanctions, they're not going away. Whether Iran cuts down its nuclear program, or whether Iran does, whatever, the sanctions are not going away until and unless Iran gives up being an Islamic revolutionary country. That's what they want. I was just watching a clip from an interview given by the pick by the Biden administration for the National Security Advisor. And you could almost remove his face and put Pompeo's face, and he was saying the same thing. The key points they have a problem with is Iran's ballistic missile program, and Iran's, as they say, support for terrorism, which is support for Ansar Allah, support for Hezbollah, support for Hamas, support for the resistance axis. This is what they want. As long as Iran is doing this, I think we need to be very clear. The sanctions from America, at least, and Europe, are not going anywhere. But on that note, Iran doesn't need America or EU. Iran has allies like Russia, like China, like other countries, the BRICS nations. And Iran can build things itself. Iran is a very strong country. It's a country that's been around far longer than America and Europe put together. Iran shouldn't be bending the knee and acting weak in front of these. I think the move that they made today in Parliament is brilliant, but long overdue. They should do it. They should have done it earlier. They should have never signed this capitulation agreement called JCPOA. Because this agreement, I don't know if any people remember, the moment it was signed in 2015, it was signed, the UN sanctions were removed, and US sanctions were applied by Obama, who everyone said was a saint and was so wonderful. Right. These people are all the same. They're all criminals. And Iran needs to, like, strengthen itself and listen to what Imam Khamenei is saying, that the days of sanctions, halas, make the sanctions irrelevant. Change the system, change the way they operate, remove the impact of these sanctions. The sanctions are irrelevant. They hurt America and other countries far more than they hurt Iran. If Iran strengthens itself and does its reliance on God like it did before.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sarbaz, Observer is saying that the Parliament plan is actually Iran's first reaction to the assassination of its eminent nuclear scientists. What's Tel Aviv trying to accomplish by virtue of this state terrorism launching against Iran?
You know, look behind to the history of the Zionist regime, you will find that this is a regime that initiated its life with terror. They started, you know, grabbing the land of Palestinians by terror groups of Haganah and blah, 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 other groups who were entering the villages and, you know, beheading the people and, you know, spreading this violence and this terror in the villages to grab the land of the Palestinians. Later on, if you follow the dynamic between this regime and other Arab countries, we see that when Egypt in the 50s tried to, you know, develop its ballistic missiles by the use of a group of the German scientists who were shifted to Cairo to help the Egyptians during the time of Jamal Abdel Nasser to develop their ballistic missile technology, Israel started its acts of terror, and those, you know, German scientists were one by one assassinated. And it was the process resulted in a stop, and all those, you know, German team, they left the they left Egypt because they were feeling there are, you know, terror attacks, you know, threatening them. Later on in the 80s, the same thing took place to Iraq when the regime of Iraq, Saddam at that time, was looking after developing some nuclear weapons by the help of the some of you know, European countries such as France. Again, the same series of the terror acts took place, the same thing took place against against Syria in 2007-2006. But don't forget, this is the reality. I mean, the terror is the reality of the Zionist regime. They are alive, so-called alive nowadays, because of their terror policy. But this terror policy is not going to work against Iran. Iran is not Iraq. Iran even is not Egypt. You know, there are differences between Iran and other countries. And even if Israel is going to stop the process of development of Iran by the use of these terror strategies, it's very clear that they are going to defeat. Because what they did, if you look behind these 10 years of the history, 10, 15 years of histories of these terrors, you should know that the terror process of the Iranian scientists, nuclear scientists, did not start at 2010. It started at 2007. When Dr. Ardashir Hosseinpour, as the first Iranian nuclear scientist who was assassinated, actually there was, you know, still their analysis going on, but he was poisoned by gas. and most possibly it was done by Mossad in 2007, later on in 2010, Dr. Ali Mohammadi, 2011, 12. But one important point is that you should remember that the head, the father of the Iranians' military technology, Shahid Tehrani Mokaddam, General Tehrani Mokaddam, who was, you know, martyred in 2011, was known to be as the father of Iranian military technology. There are also some, you know, some analysis telling that that event that took place in which Shahid Tehrani Mokaddam was martyred, it was also a sabotage, you know, act of the Zionist regime as well.
Right.
But within eight years, from 2011, when Shahid Tehrani Mokaddam, the father of the Iranian missile technology, was martyred in Tehran, within 8 years, the Iranian missiles hit the American base in Ain al-Assad in Iraq in 2019. Mm-hmm. So the physical elimination of the Iranian scientists and Iranian prominent figures by the terrorist acts of the Zionist regime is not going to work, as it did not mm-hmm. work related to the Iranian, you know, missile technology. The same is going to take place. And after this, as I mentioned, after the decision of the Iranian parliament, it's very clear. It's a system.
Right.
It's not a matter of a few people here and there that you eliminate them and you will stop the process. Stop the process. That's not going to work.
Now, Shabir, some observers argued that this recent assassination of the Iranian scientists was meant to hinder diplomacy with Iran. Are you of the same opinion?
I think what the Netanyahu's and Trumps of the world, the less diplomatic terrorists, if you like, what they wanted was to create a situation where Iran does a knee-jerk reaction to this, starts a war, and halas. And so, yes, they are scared of the nuclear deal, the dead nuclear deal, somehow coming back, because it's very strange. Look, Mossad, CIA, all of these people, they know that this nuclear deal is not anything to do with Iran's nuclear power ambitions and work. The entire thing is about Iran's support for the resistance axis and Iran's ballistic missile program and defense program, and its alliance with Russia and China and so on. Mm-hmm. It's nothing to do with the nuclear program. The nuclear program is, I mean, everyone knows this has been proven time and time again, even by the CIA, by NSA, by Mossad. All of them know this, you know. It's just the media that keeps saying nuclear weapons, nuclear weapons. They know that Imam Khamenei has said nuclear weapons are prohibited. So they will keep on trying to do this. Now, the reason for the deal, why these people don't like the deal, is because, as far as they see, it alleviated, in quotes, some sanctions. And yes, maybe alleviated one or two types of sanctions, maybe. But the reality is, it's more psychological. They don't want someone to come and do a deal with Iran again. And in a way, a deal with America, anyone who has studied the history of deals that America has made with Iran or with anyone else, you cannot make a deal with America. First of all, America is an infantile country. It's a country whose administration and as an entity, it's less than 300 years old, of which 240 or 250 of those years, it's been in a state of war. It's never had a chance to mature. America is not capable of negotiating fairly and honorably with anyone, even its own neighbors. I mean, this is just like the situation we have in the UK, where the UK is unable to negotiate with even its neighbors for a deal. This negotiation talk, it's a placebo. It doesn't really solve anything.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is what they want is they want Iran to abandon its ballistic missile program that Sarbaz Ruhullah just spoke about, from that was headed up by Mata Tehrani Mokaddam, and they want Iran to stop its support of the resistance axis, and especially of the Palestinians. If Iran was to do this, then they will negotiate and they will throw money into Iran. They will make Iran everything. You know, they will make Iran a heaven on earth in terms of the Western and the materialist eyes. But Iran will betray the revolution and the blood of the thousands, hundreds of thousands that died in making the victory of the revolution and the eight-year imposed war and so on and so forth,
mm-hmm.
if Iran was to do that. And Iran won't. Iran is a resilient country. It's wise. It's intelligent. And I know many people have been talking about, oh, what's Iran's response going to be? I think, like you have said, and the other guest has said, this response by Parliament is one tiny element of it. And the enemy needs to understand that Iran is not a country that will just knee-jerk into anything. Iran will take its time. At the end of the day, one of the key things that Iran manufactures are Persian carpets. And Persian carpets take years to manufacture. Anyone who knows anything about them knows. So Iran has got plenty of patience. But one thing we need to be wary about and be careful about is the Zionists creating a false flag attack in somewhere like the Emirates or somewhere in that region, blaming it on Iran and using that as a pretext. And I think Dr. Khoshash had spoken about that earlier on, or had written about it earlier on, which people can find online.
Okay. Now, Saba Azrullah, the European side of JCPOA has only given lip service, as you know, and insisted the deal must be protected. Yet in practice, they haven't done much to allow Iran to benefit economically, as per the agreement. You know, banking operations, business transactions have been blocked, sale of crude is facing obstruction. What's Europe waiting for?
I think Europe has proven to be, a puppet of the Americans, and they are highly dependent on the policies of America. So when there is a change of policies in the United States of America, and there's a change of the administration over there, Europe is also changing its stand. So it's exactly the case that you mentioned, that there's nothing beyond lip servicing on behalf of the Europeans. They were not even able to solve the simple issue of SWIFT and simple issue of banking between Iran and the European country, which was so-called independent from the, from the American side of the story, and from the United States side of the story. You know, they were not that involved, but even Europeans were not able to solve that banking process between Iran, because they are so-called, with JCPOA. They even by their statements, they condemn the act of terror against Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. They all condemn it. But when it comes to the reality on the ground, nothing is taking place, and it's all because, unfortunately, still they are, obedient. They are, followers and puppets of the Americans as well as the Zionists, because of the pressures of the lobbies, Zionist lobbies over there, as well as the dependency of the European countries towards the United States of America, unfortunately.
So if you
so everything is related to the...
Yeah, we have only 1 minute left, if I could put the last question to Shabir. Shabir, what do you anticipate will be the fate of the JCPOA at the threshold of a new administration assuming power at the White House? 1 minute, please.
I think JCPOA is dead. It was dead at the beginning when it was signed. It is dead now. And I think the people that still think it's alive need to accept that it's dead. The Trump administration, Biden administration, Republican, Democrat, makes no difference. They are the same. And, those people who worked very hard for JCPOA, inshallah, they will be rewarded. They need to sit down, maybe go through the grieving process, do a fatiha, as we do when someone passes away, and realize that there is no deal with the U.S. or with the Western powers until they treat Iran as an equal. If they don't, then they can go to hell.
Okay, so it's like flogging dead horse, in your opinion. Thank you very much for your comments and contribution. We had peace and justice activist and analyst Saba Azrullah Rezi from Qom, and writer and political commentator Shabir Hassan Ali, who joined us out of Leicester. Up in your host, Behrouz Najaf, and I'll see you next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
عليٌ حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
Jannah, إمام الناس والجنة علي حبه جنة قسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
You're listening to the program Gates of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge. We have been discussing about the qualities of the pious people in Nahjul Balagha, sermon number 184, which is famously known as the Sermon of the Pious People. Here is where Imam Ali alayhi salam explains some of the very important qualities and necessities for one to become pious or of a pious person. And also, while mentioning those qualities, he also creates that feeling in a person to really try to achieve those qualities. If you notice the way the style of the and the speeches, if a person can go through it in Arabic, would be very beneficial. Of course, if he doesn't understand Arabic, then referring to the translation is also beneficial. We reach this phrase where Imam Ali alayhi salam says, تَرَاهُ قَرِيبًا أَمَلُهُ قَلِيلًا زَلَلُهُ خَاشِعًا قَلْبُهُ. That a pious person is one whose aims and hopes are clear-cut, short, achievable, based on firm principles. قَرِيبًا أَمَلُهُ قَلِيلًا زَلَلُهُ. His mistakes are less. And then he says finally, خَاشِعًا قَلْبُهُ, that his heart is humble, his heart is at a state of humility. This is a quality that is there in a pious person.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, normally it is difficult for a person to see and to understand whether truly a person's heart is humble. It's difficult because a person might act very nicely that he is humble and good. But here Imam Ali alayhi salam says, Tarahu, you will see that his heart is humble. That means there must be a few signs to show that humility in the heart. At the end of the day, many times what is inside the heart shows up in the tongue, shows up in the actions. A person will notice that a pious person is not like this. He will see that always that state of humility of the heart is there in him. In one of the narrations we have that the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam was seeing that a man was praying the salah, but he was, while praying the salah, was playing with his beard, actually, you know, like maybe rolling it with his fingers and stuff like that, whatever, he was just playing with his beard. The Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said when he saw this, amma annahu law khasha'a qalbuhu la khasha'at جَوَارِحُهُ. If his heart was humble, then his body would also be in a state of humility. Yes, we cannot see the humility that is in the heart, but the sign that we see that he is playing around with his beard in prayer shows that his heart is not in a state of humility. So normally, the humility of the heart is shown in the way a person obeys Allah, in the way a person prays to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in the way a person, you know, cries to his Lord. That state is shown. These are just signs that show that a person is pious. Of course, we should not be taken aback by apparent signs very clearly, because sometimes they can be misleading. At the time of Imam Ali alayhi salam, Imam was accompanied by one of his companions, and they heard someone reciting Quran in a very beautiful and sad voice. Then this companion of Imam Ali alayhi salam says that, "Oh, this man must be very spiritually close to God. He must be very humble in his heart to be able to recite the Quran like this with so much sadness." Immediately Imam Ali alayhi salam told him that this should not be a reason for you to judge the veracity and the humility of the heart of the person. Because, and he told him, "You will come to know," something like that. Like,
stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
So, later on, building up to that story, Imam Ali alayhi salam, as I said previously, that there was a person who was reciting Quran in a very the Holy Quran in a very sad voice, and Imam Ali alayhi salam told his companion that don't be taken aback by this statement of this person. And these words of the person, and this apparent state of the person. Later on in the battle, in one of the battles, Imam Ali alayhi salam showed him, "Look, this person who has died, this is the same person who was reciting Quran in the middle of the night, and we heard his voice." Meaning that he truly, his heart was not humble. He was just, sometimes it's a fake feeling, a fake state that a person brings about in himself, which is quite dangerous, when a person might feel that he is doing the right thing while he is doing the wrong thing. There are people who, even to the last breath, to their last breaths, as they were evil, committed crimes, but still they felt that they are in the right path. There was a problem in their hearts. There was a sickness. There is a sickness in their hearts. This sickness can be very dangerous. What we want is that true servitude, that true humility towards Allah, which is accompanied by true obedience, especially to the awliya, obeying those who Allah has told us to obey. Otherwise, shaytan, the devil, had told Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, "If you allow me not to worship Adam, not to humiliate myself, not to put my head bow down to Adam, I will bow down to you in a way that no one has ever bowed down. Ever. I'll bow down to you in that way." But he was wrong, because this apparent state of bowing down had nothing to do with the true humility in his heart, which was supposed to be through obeying Allah, to submit himself to Adam alayhi salam. Let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He gives us the opportunity to have the true humility in our hearts. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد مجيد والمجيد حضن يمناه